Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Damian Thompson. This week, we bring you a special interview with one of our most popular and influential bloggers, Norman Tebbit, former chairman of the Tory party, who, as Lord Tebbit, is a powerful, independent, and sometimes truculent voice in British politics. In a wide-ranging interview, Tim Stanley asks Norman about his view of modern politicians, his love of game shooting, and his sometimes hair-raising other career as an airline pilot.
Lord Tebbit, there are some compelling themes that arise from your blog, one of which is about British politics in general. A political class has sort of arisen in the last few years with very little experience of work at the coalface, either Tory or Labour. If you look at the green benches and compare them to what you saw when you were elected in Parliament in 1970, what differences do you think there are?
Well, one of the big differences, of course, is that in 1970, a great many of those sitting there had served through the war, seen active service. And that made quite a difference. Whether you're an old Etonian peer or a poor boy from a rough background, if you've shared the same slit trench, scared out of your wits, there's a bond between you of a kind which we now don't get. And so men like Willie Whitelaw, Peter Carrington, or in the Lords, of course, that kind of chap, Alec Douglas Hume, had a bond which now doesn't exist. The other thing I think which I notice is that almost all of us had done some other job, one way or another, or on our side perhaps landowners and things of that kind. On the Labour side, the guys who were elected as trades union members of Parliament had almost all of them worked on the shop floor or down the mines before becoming a trades unionist or a trades union official. Now, on both sides, school, university, research department at central office, perhaps some research department in a trades union, professional trades unionist, professional politician, a much narrower experience.
Well, you could be describing the Prime Minister there, Lord Tebbit. I mean, he is a man of that sort of background
himself.
Well,
not only the Prime Minister, but Mr. Clegg, Mr. Miliband. It's right, shot right the way through what I now call the Westminster Village.
Right. The new breed of Tory MP, if they don't have that kind of personal experience, that kind of experience at the coalface, does that sort of limit their ability to make the right decisions? I mean, do you think that affects the nature of politics in this country? Does it affect policy?
I think it does. Of course, there are some who do have a great deal of experience outside, including some with recent combat experience in the armed forces. But I think it tends to insulate you from the other party's point of view. So you see the world divided rather artificially. And then you get into this trap of talking about moving onto the centre ground or moving away from the centre ground, when what one should be seeking is common ground. And that's a very, very different thing. And recently, of course, Ian Duncan Smith has discovered the common ground. Michael Gove has discovered the common ground. And I think we're thrashing around trying to find it in relation to the National Health Service, but not very successfully yet.
I think some listeners will be surprised to hear you bemoaning the partisanship, because you know your time in politics in the 1980s was a period which was terribly partisan. And Margaret Thatcher is a figure who is regarded as very, very partisan. And yet it's interesting to hear you expressing, I sense, some desire for a greater consensus building.
Not with the leadership of the Labour Party, but with many of its voters. And I think one has to have a realistic appreciation of the history of things. I regard Attlee and Bevin as two of the great figures of 20th century politics. Now, a lot of my colleagues are quite horrified when I express that view. But I remind them of the track record of that post-war Attlee government. It was the government which helped create NATO. It was the government which first gave us nuclear weapons and which rearmed in the face of the Soviet Union. I tend to forget that sometimes.
What about their domestic accomplishments? I mean, would you rate those as well, the creation of the welfare state? Even if it does have its flaws, do you think it contributed something to the life of the nation that's worth preserving?
I think the creation of the National Health Service and the implementation of the Beveridge Report were great steps. Unfortunately, they didn't implement Beveridge as he expected and had hoped.
Mm-hmm.
They created a welfare-dependent society instead of a society which used welfare to get people back to making their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Frank Field and Duncan Smith have been trying to do.
Okay. You talk quite often in your work about a concept of Britishness and British identity. How would you define the British spirit, and what is it about it that so inspires you?
I think that's an extraordinarily difficult thing to define.
Okay.
It's like an elephant. It's difficult to define, but you'll recognise it when you see one.
Uh-huh.
I think there are all sorts of strands to it. Quite obviously, the Christian religion has played a great part of that. Part of it also is an inherent polite bolshiness.
A polite bolshiness.
You can't push an Englishman around. He will stand his ground. He expects the police to serve him. He doesn't expect to be servile to the police. Things of that kind, which are important. And they've grown, really, because we've had the good fortune not to have suffered a civil war for, 400 years or so. And that is extraordinarily important, almost unbroken from Magna Carta through to today. And there have been tussles, yes, there have been nasty moments, but there's been a bond despite that. I think all those bits and pieces are part of the British character.
What about the concept of shame? Do you think that's changed at all?
I think, regrettably, the concept of shame has almost been abolished.
Mm-hmm.
It's my human right not to be ashamed of anything. one reads perfectly respectable magazines like The Spectator, and you find several articles every week in which the author is proclaiming his or her drunken exploits and sexual exploits, which basically I'm not terribly interested in. I don't think it makes awfully good reading.
Is there also a social benefit to shame?
There is, very strongly. I recollect that soon after I was elected in 1970, I was propositioned to do something or the other, and I can't even remember what it was now. And I thought this was perhaps not quite kosher. So I asked Harry Legge Burke, the member for the Isle of Ely, ramrod straight ex-soldier, who was the chairman of the 1922 committee. Harry, let me tell you what I've been asked to do. Could you tell me, what do you think I should do? Norman, dear boy, he said, I wouldn't dream to advise you about that. Not at all. It's entirely a matter for you. But if you wouldn't want to see it on the front page of the Daily Mail tomorrow, don't do it. And how many of my colleagues would have been saved from embarrassment if they'd only thought, would I like this on the front page of the Daily Mail tomorrow? Or
yeah.
The Daily Telegraph, indeed.
I'm sure we wouldn't print it, don't worry.
Well, you printed a lot of it.
I know also that you feel a great passion for the countryside and that you also shoot game. A sport which I think some people might perhaps, in an antiquated way, think of as being rather upper class. How did you come to get involved in that sport, and what does it mean to you?
Well, first of all, I should say that my maternal grandfather was a butcher. Perhaps it's in the genes. He had retired long before the Second World War, but occasionally he would visit us during the war. bringing a most welcome gift of a pair of brace of rabbits or something of that kind. And he always maintained, of course, that a poached rabbit tasted better than any other one. And I got interested in that sort of food at that time. And then my wife was a great cook. And being an airline pilot, I was either totally away or at home. So we shared things in the kitchen. She made it plain that if I expected to share her bed, I was expected to share her kitchen. And so I cooked. And then after she was injured, of course, most of the cooking did fall to me. And then I got into shooting, mainly because she felt that I needed something to take my mind off politics. I think subsequently she wished she could think of something to take my mind off shooting from October to February.
Is it really an obsession?
It did become such. I don't do as much now. I used to shoot quite a lot.
What was it about it? What was it about it that was so enthralling?
Well, first of all, it's competitive with yourself to try to do better. And secondly, it is a great thing because it doesn't require a great deal of brain power and thought. You're not working your brain terribly hard, but it is sufficiently working hard that you don't think about anything else. So really it's not a cerebral occupation, but it crowds out all thoughts of work or anything else. So you're totally focused on that bird coming your way.
Okay. So, well, one thing in your life that I hope would have required a lot of concentration and brain power is flying planes. How did you come to be a commercial air pilot?
Well, when I really want to send up some rather wet, soft lefty, which is most of the time, I explained that when I left school at 16, I was determined to become a journalist, and I joined the Financial Times. But then later I received a very pressing offer to become an assassin. It was made to me on the highest authority of His Majesty, who sent me the papers and required me to report, and they trained me as a fighter pilot.
A
fighter pilot is a professional assassin.
Right.
His job is to preferably creep up behind the enemy, whether his enemy is armed or not, whether he's going to the battle or running away from the battle, and preferably shoot him in the back neatly and cleanly. That's the job of a fighter pilot.
Very different from the job of a commercial pilot, of course. Did you have any? Obviously, I mean that's one side of it. But you also would have put your life at extraordinary risk. It's something which you really are putting your life on the line for. Were there ever any near misses? Did you ever sort of look death in the face?
Well, in the early 50s, we were basically flying aeroplanes which had the armaments and the equipment of a 1938 fighter, but very much faster, very much more high performance, with very limited endurance. And sometimes that led to considerable problems. Without any aids, really, one would got to find one's way back, preferably to one's own airfield, but at least somewhere where you could land if the weather turned sour on you. And that was quite testing. And I don't know how many pilots died during those early post-war years, the Cold War years. But, of course, we didn't make a fuss about it. I recollect one weekend, a single weekend during an air exercise, when Fighter Command lost 6 aeroplanes and 4 pilots killed. And nobody stood up in the House of Commons to list their names and make ritual noises about it.
Nobody ever thought of suing anyone?
Good God, no. You know, that was what you were in for. And it was a terrific life. We enjoyed it enormously. And yes, I had a couple of nasty moments. I had a disagreement with my aircraft early one Sunday morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, as a result of which the aircraft was written off and I survived, which was better than the other way around. And, because I one day foolishly insisted on continuing an exercise, air firing exercise off the East Coast in weather when I should really have called it off. It finished up with my number two losing sight of me in poor weather and suddenly finding me unexpectedly right in front of him.
Wow.
So there was a bit of an impact which frightened the hell out of both of us.
Well, when did you last fly a plane?
When did I last fly an airplane? I suppose it must have been the late 70s, really. I was elected to the House of Commons in 1970, which forced me to give up my career. I kept flying as much as I could to keep my hand in case I didn't make it at the next election, mm-hmm. and had to go back to flying again. And then eventually I had to conclude there's no fool like an old fool. And it wasn't sensible to try to keep my hand in and not do enough flying, so I gave up.
Okay. One other thing that I want to cover is what you sometimes talk about taking spiritual solace in our island history. And I know that you sometimes attend Evensong at St. Albans Cathedral. And yet it's obvious that you're a fellow traveller when it comes to Christianity, but not necessarily a paid-up believer. Is that a fair description?
That is a fair description. First of all, I'm culturally a Christian. Secondly, I find it puzzling to think how one can really have a sense of morals and of right and wrong if one doesn't accept the proposition that there is perhaps some higher authority than ourselves. But as to the literal matter of Christianity, well, there I have a lot of doubts. And I keep my fingers crossed quite often during the service at Bury St. Edmunds, where I tend to go to Evensong. I tell my friends in the church that there were never very many members of the Communist Party in this country. But at one time it had huge influence because of the number of fellow travellers.
Right.
And I tell my friends in the church that they have to realise that there are not many people who are totally and absolutely convinced and committed to all the doctrines of the church and its history. But there are a lot of us who are fellow travellers. We will stay on that Christian bus as long as we think that the driver knows where he is going, that he's not driving recklessly, that he's not lost, and he's not likely to ditch the bus. If we think any of those things, we will get off the bus. We're the early warning system to the church. We're the canaries in the coal mine.
Is there a risk that the Anglican Church is a little bit lost at this point, that it's taken a wrong turn?
I think the Anglican Church has been quite a bit lost in recent years. I hope that the new Archbishop Welby will help it to find its way. But I worry when I hear churchmen say that the church must catch up with the social changes of recent years. That sounds as though the driver's not sure of the way.
Or if he's encouraging the passengers to drive instead. Has this form of spirituality helped you during some of the tougher moments in your life? I mean, I know that your life was changed dramatically by the Brighton bomb and that you've spent a great deal of time caring for your wife. Have all these things, the shooting, the cooking, going to church, faith in Britain, has this sort of been a great strength to you?
Perhaps so. It's hard to say because it perhaps permeates one in a way that we're not entirely conscious of. I just go my way. Yes, we've had some difficult times, having some difficult times. But on the other hand, I've had some awfully good fun times. And I often reflect that overall the balance in my life has been, as far as I'm concerned, positive for me rather than negative. I don't often sit in a corner and cry about it.
Do you enjoy blogging?
Yes, I do enjoy blogging. Sometimes I find that those who read my blog and comment on it cause me some irritation.
But you do fight back?
Oh, good gracious me, yes. I suppose there's a streak of Irish temperament in me that if I see a good fight going, I can't quite resist the temptation to get involved.
Does it remind you of a very old-fashioned kind of politics where you would really confront people head-on? And
I think it does. Years ago, before either of us were elected to the House of Commons, Cecil Parkinson and I were both working as in the Conservative Party as volunteers in Hemel Hempstead in the New Town, which was a tough place for Tories in those days. And we ran a soapbox operation in the shopping centre on Saturdays. And essentially, that's what a blog is. It's a soapbox in the street. And I think that unless when you're on the soapbox, you're prepared to take on the chap that shouts something from the back of the crowd, you know, it's not very lively. I like taking them on, although it's a very time-consuming process. And there are one or two of them who I really do wish would go away or would learn to express themselves a little more concisely and a little more politely.
Lord Tebbit, thank you very much.
Thanks.